Blog Talk Radio.
Your floors are under attack, from overwatered plants to overflowing dog bowls. But the Home Depot has new water-resistant Pergo Outlast Plus laminate flooring starting at just $279 a square foot. So you and your floors get to fight back with 24-hour spill protection that stands up to liquids for a whole day without causing damage. The next generation of laminate flooring is Pergo Outlast Plus, starting at just $279 a square foot, exclusively from the Home Depot. More saving, more doing, U.S. only.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to the Horoscope Detective Show. This is your host, Isakar Bay, and we're definitely excited about today's show. We're going to have on our show today someone who's definitely very well known, one of the, I guess you could say, forefathers. Somebody who's definitely very, very important in the astrological community. Actually, he's somebody who I've always been very fond of, and definitely somebody who's very important to me because of the path that I've taken in the astrological community. And then studying many different levels and just being integrated into the community when I was back in New York City. And so it's definitely a pleasure to have this gentleman come on. We're going to have with us today Gary Christian, who's a well-renowned astrologer. Also, he's the CEO of Astrolabe. Hello, Gary, are you here? Okay, we don't know. Wait a minute, it's not on yet. But he's definitely somebody who's definitely very profound. Actually, he's also responsible, the publisher of SolarFire. Those of you that use the SolarFire software, Gary has spent most of his time working at Astrolabe, and he's also the founder and the creator of Nova Chart Wheels. He specializes in symmetrical astrology, which he has created based on the many different types of astrology, Uranian cosmobiology, and just some other techniques. He's also been heavily influenced by Arthur Blackwell, which we're going to ask him about very shortly. So we definitely would like to find out more about that. Those of you that want to call in, the call-in number is 718-664-9735. And when you call in, you're going to press the number 1, and this will indicate to us that you have a question or comment. Those of you that want to join us in the chat room, please feel free to join in. So we just actually right now we're just waiting for him to call in. So those of you that want to call in and ask any questions or comments, please feel free. Last week we had a great show. We had Alpha Lavoie. Those of you that missed it, was a great show. Definitely a great show. We actually went into some great things and about Harari. We got into the financial market. He has a great software. Those of you that you can always go to horoscopedetective.com on Blog Talk Radio to listen to the old shows so that you guys can get the playback and listen in. And then also coming up, we're going to be having Arlene Kramer, who's also another Uranian astrologer. She's confirmed that she's going to be coming on. So we have a lot of good things coming on. Deborah Hogan, out of the UK, she's going to be coming on, and you know, we are definitely looking forward to some great guests. Also, those of you that are listening, if you have any astrologers or any guests that you would like to have on the show, please feel free to contact us and let us know, you know, different shows, different topics, maybe different things that you may want to discuss. And so we're definitely here to make sure that you guys are being sort of compensated for your time. You know, we always want to feel that you guys are definitely being compensated for your time as you take time to listen to our show. And we definitely thank you for taking the time to be on the show. Those of you that are listening, you can also go to the website, which is horoscopedetective.com. You can opt in with your name and email and join the mailing list. I send out newsletters. We have a lot of different things going on with ISAR, who's having a conference. They're having a conference in September. Also, UAC, which is actually next week. They're having their astrological conference. So definitely to stay in tune with what's going on in the astrological community, NCGR, OPA, all the different organizations, AFA. Definitely stay connected, and we pretty much will keep you guys locked in. We also want to encourage you guys to give us the feedback of what it is that you need, what it is that you would like to see as far as questions, comments, anything that you guys feel necessary. I will be lecturing again on May 27th here in Las Vegas. I did a talk at the NCGR on the beginning of the introduction to Uranian astrology, and got an email just about 2 days ago, and they want to have me back again. So that's real exciting about that. I'm really excited about that. And we're looking forward to having another great time. So those of you in the Las Vegas area, if you want to be a part of that lecture, you can actually email me or contact me. I can give you the address. It's going to be May 27th, and I believe that's Tuesday, the last Tuesday in May, and we will be doing a part two to the introduction of Uranian astrology. So definitely, I would like to see those of you that can be there. We had a great time last time, and this time we really want to expand. Also, Mark has definitely been a great asset in bringing that along, and so we definitely thank him as the president of the NCGR chapter here in Vegas. So we definitely want to see you guys be a part of that. Those of you that are tuning in, we have with us Gary Christian. We're just waiting for him to call in. He has a little technical difficulty, so if you want to call in and discuss anything, the call-in number is 718-664-9735. Also, if you want to join us in the chat room, feel free, and we will definitely be anticipating your feedback. Also, I'm going to be having a gentleman by the name of David Perkins. He's going to be on the show May 29th. He just wrote a book called Hitler's Astrologer, and I was very interested about the topic because those of you that know me know that I'm into Uranian. So he actually wrote a book about Hitler's astrologer. He's going to come on the show. We're going to get into the book and really get into understanding what's going on with Hitler's astrologer, the whole phenomenon, the whole scenery, was what was going on during that time. And we're really looking forward to getting a copy of the book as well. So those of you that are listening, if you definitely want to chime into that, maybe put that on your calendar. May 29th, we will be having David Perkins, who is the author of Hitler's Astrologer. So, as I said before, you know, I want to thank all of you for definitely being a part of the show. Definitely, we definitely look forward to you guys see that and continuing to listen and continuing to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. So definitely, this is a great time. Everything that's going on right now in our world as we speak, you know, with the with the Donald Sterling, girls in Nigeria, all these different world events, different things that are happening. It's not by surprise with this great grand course that we just had, Mars being retrograde, Saturn still retrograde. So it's a lot of things going on right now. So well, while we wait for Gary to call in, I was just going to a little bit about just a little bit about Uranian astrology. Uranian astrology is a system that I guess it said starts with Alfred Witt back in 1911, and coming out of the Hamburg, Germany, and I would say that you would go all the way back to the beginning with the mother of Reinhold Eberton, and it was kind of, I guess, brought together based on the ideas that were heavily used on the Arabic parts, based on directions configured with Arabic parts. And Witt began by writing articles and started really getting into it. He went off to World War One and was assigned to the Russian front with the corporation. And therefore, he advanced, and he began training in Latin and Greek, which was mandatory during that time. And he was able to read a lot of astrological materials, and those materials that he basically had that were teaching him were destroyed during World War II. He came back from World War II with all of this information, and then he created, or I guess put together this symmetrical Uranian system, and you know, it's composed of his ideas of how he was able to bring together his knowledge and vast understanding of the symmetrical system. Those of you that are sidereolists may understand the typical foundation of the system and how he brought it forth, and how going back into it, looking at Ptolemy's work, you would understand why it's important that somebody comes along like Alfred Witt and gathers up ideas and concepts and brings them together, and really gets that understanding. One of the people who I feel is also who we also are in contact with getting on the show is Bruce Schofield. Bruce Schofield is somebody who I also feel is very vital in Uranian astrology, especially in as far as bringing it in the early days to America. As far as connecting with Gary Christian and all those other guys, he also had a vast understanding of it, and really had a great understanding of it. But one of the things that I feel also about the Uranian system is that what the Uranian system does is that it, to me, it's like putting on a pair of 3D glasses. It takes the chart and it brings to it a level of vision that takes it to another level. What you would see, what we call the flat chart, the main natal horoscope, when you put a natal chart on the dial, it expands it and gives it the ability to see things that you wouldn't normally see, or get the information that you wouldn't normally be able to get just from the flat chart. And so you're able to expound and really expand to that level. You begin to understand that when you work on the Tao and begin to understand the Tao, that you begin to see and understand the concepts of how the Uranian system was put together. There were eight planets, or hypothetical planets, as some would call them, that were created between Alpha Wit, Capito, Hades, Zeus, Kronos, Apollon, Admetos, Volcanus, Poseidon. These are the eight trans-Neptunians, the eight hypothetical planets, if you want to call them, that they use in the Uranian system. The Uranian system also uses the 360-degree dial, which I think is very phenomenal. It's it actually allows you to see the chart in the different house systems. For instance, there's the Senate houses, there's the moon houses, and so this dial allows us to get great information. We also, as far as the flat chart is concerned, we use the meridian house system, which is based off the meridian. If you are able to get your hands on the language of astrology, it's also a great book to have. There's many great books, Rules for Planetary Pictures. You also have Maria K. Sims, The Tao Detective, which is a great introduction into working with the Tao and kind of understanding the system somewhat from the beginner stage. You also have Rules for Planetary Pictures. There's also the Phoenix Workshop that Penelope put out as well. And so we have that as well. So as we said before, the Uranian system is a system that I feel is very, very profound. And it's a system that I feel that once you get a grasp of it, really get an understanding of it, it will change your life. There's a woman by the name of Susan Herskowitz, and she's the she has some great videos on YouTube about Uranian astrology. She did a great documentary on Uranian astrology. We're going to have her on the show as well. And she just posted this documentary of Uranian astrology. It's awesome. So if you ever get a chance to go to YouTube, you can just type in Uranian astrology, and you will see it come up. Definitely a great documentary. We want to also welcome you guys. We're just waiting for, as I said before, for Gary Christian to call in. Those of you that want to call in, that call in number is 718-664-9735. And once you call in, you can press the number 1. Hello, you're on the air.
Islam, how you doing, brother man?
Hey, how you doing, man?
Hey, this is Brother Paul out of New Jersey.
Okay.
Got a quick question for you. I was listening to what you said, and I apologize, I'm outside. Could you repeat the person's name you were talking about with regards to the First World War and after the Second World War compiling the works together?
I was talking about Alfred Witt. Alfred Witt is actually what happened was Alfred Witt began Uranian astrology, basically going back to, like I said, studying with Reinhold Everton's mother back in like 1911. He started in Hamburg, Germany, the Hamburg School. And he was a surveyor by trade. He went off to World War One, where he was assigned to the Russian front. And then because he had to, basically go into World War One, he, basically was able to get hold of this astrological material that he was able to get hold of. and he began to learn how to calculate, begin to how to advance notice when the battles would occur. He was able to find out when the artillery would be fired. He would use this information with his axiological theories because he was a surveyor. And then he began to study Latin and Greek, which was mandatory at that time. And during that time, as I said before, he was able to definitely read and basically take in a whole lot of astrological material. These materials that he had was destroyed later in World War II. He came back from the war with all these different ideas, concepts, because these are things that he had used. That he had come into knowledge of, that he had come into possession of during those wars. And so once he came back from World War II, he hadn't really put the system together yet, but he had a lot of connection of techniques, and he was able to really hone his skills on a symmetrical on the symmetrical levels of astrology, the dynamics of it, and basically put together the many systems that he learned over that period of time. And then during that time, he was able to come up with the Uranian system. And during those times, but what you were asking about is World War I, World War II, is basically that concept of during that time of Alfred Witt.
Yeah, Brother Bay, I only caught that part of it. Give me a phonetic spelling on his last name, please.
Witte.
All right, thank you. Let's check it out.
All right. We're gonna bring on Gary Fishman. Hello, Gary. Are you here?
Yes, I'm here. How you doing?
How you doing, Gary? Thank you for tuning in. Those of you that are listening, we have with us Gary Fishman. Definitely an honor to have him on the show. Those of you that don't know, he is the president of Astrolabe. He is the which also publishes Solar Fire, Nova Chart Wheels. He is one of the forefront people, I believe, in Uranian astrology. Somebody who's definitely very important when it comes to the expansion or the evolution, I believe, or just the astrology breaking out of its eggshell and becoming so popular and so profound. So it's definitely an honor to have you. Gary, just real quickly, tell us a little bit about how you started and who are some of your influences that really got you involved or really got you kind of really wanting to grasp astrology and really take hold of it as you have so thus far.
Well, I started in 1968, and I was a complete skeptic. I walked into the New York Astrology Center because a teacher at college had said that Saturn was entering Taurus, and it meant 2 years of work and responsibility. And I'm a Taurus, and I said, "What the hell is this all about?" And they sold me $40 worth of books, which in 1968 was quite a bit of books. And I went home and I began to figure astrology out. I came back to the New York Astrology Center and volunteered to work for them, and in exchange for classes. It was there that I met Hans Nigemann and Wayne Boeher, as well as Arthur Blackwell, who's a sidereal astrologer but actually plays a major role in the evolution of Uranian. So I studied with Hans for one class, and then he turned the class over to Wayne Boeher, but Boeher had a very good grasp of the system. And it just made so much more sense than orthodox astrology. And I became hooked pretty quick.
How did you meet Hans Nigemann? What was your experience working with Hans?
Well, as I said, the first thing I looked at when I went into the New York Astrology Center on 6th Street, where they had these weird mimeographed books that were all had upside-down pages and stuff in them, and it was real metaphysical. And it was by Hans, and they said to me basically, "Oh no, you can't study with him now. You'll get to meet him later." And at some point, he came in and we met, and along with Charles Jane, and I just began to study with him at that point. Now, later on, he and I collaborated, Hans and I collaborated on a few projects. One of them had to do with the dials with Wayne. We had the dial concession. We made dials. And the other had to do with cleaning up his translation of the Key to Uranian Astrology. So we worked together up through about 1976. And then we had a major fight, and we both went in different directions. Hans passed away when they discovered the Titanic, on the day that they found the Titanic in September of 1985, I believe. That's when he passed from this earth. He was 96. So I knew him when he was still cognizant and still talking and stuff. But he was an amazing character.
One of the things I wanted to ask you also, Gary, is as far as your connection to Uranian astrology, what was it that really, really intrigued you about Uranian astrology and system? And I know that you've been around Rob Payne, you have been around all these other astrologers, but when you got introduced to the Uranian the Uranian system, what was it that really grabbed you and really pulled you in that direction?
It made sense. This was a system that basically is constructed along the lines of a modern science. And what Vitta really did was he went back, he had a classical education. The guy was the surveyor for the city of Hamburg up and through World War One, and he was a middle-class character. He was trained in Latin and Greek and this and that. And in Europe, the materials were much more accessible than they were here in the States, particularly before World War One, before the libraries all got bombed and everything else. So he was able to read all the materials coming forward from the ancient times, Firmicus Maternus, Ptolemy, all this stuff, directly. And particularly he liked Kepler, he liked Marinus, and he was real hung up on Greek astrology. So what he does is, he does what Kepler called for, and that was he cleaned up the baby of astrology, threw out the dirty water, and preserved the most important elements that makes astrology unique. Now, one of the things he throws away, of course, is symbolic connection. In other words, the concept of rulerships and the way that it's used in ancient astrology coming forward. And this is critical, because this is the magical part of the astrological system. It's a very good call on his part. If we look at the Mayan astrology or the work that's coming out of the Babylonians, you see no context of symbolic astrology. But yet this idea, which arises with the Greeks, of planets having domiciles and places where they're liked and places where they're not liked, it seems to mimic more the Greek social structure or the social structure of any king-like regime with a clan than anything else. And if we eliminate just that one portion from things, our astrology becomes very dynamic in nature. In other words, we have to look at direct hits, not symbolic hits. We have to look at material as it's actually happening. Now, the other thing begins to emphasize as well that really catches one's attention is the cardinal axis. Now, the cardinal axis, of course, permeates ancient astrology. It's one of the first things one notes if one's going to construct an astrology. You put a stick in the ground and look at the shadow over the course of a year, and you could figure out where the cardinal axis is, how the angle of the sun is, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't used by the ancients in the way that Vitta begins to use it in the 20th century. And it had to do with the conception of the earth. In ancient times, things were very local. The ascendant was critical. An astrologer would judge you by your ascendant more than anything else, whether or not you're going to pay him for the reading or not. It was your outer form. The cardinal axis, on the other hand, determined the start of the zodiac and interplay of the earth and the sun, but Vitta expands its significance to rule all things of the earth. So the idea that we can get into a jet plane and fly across the country in 6 hours and have an entirely different horoscope when we get off that plane someplace else, right, is a cardinal function. The idea that a character could become known worldwide is a cardinal function. And these things were only possible in this century, in this last century that's passed, with the evolution of railroad trains going 400 miles a day, followed by automobiles and then planes. Our expansion globally goes crazy. So he was pretty well ahead of his time in terms of the implications of that. These concepts, just those two concepts alone, were the entry ticket into the system. The use of dials, the use of planetary pictures, the concept of doing dynamic interactions with the solar arc, all these things make the system function with repeatability, with great regularity, very easy to see things and organize the material. So we have to think in terms of the way people conceptualize. In the ancient world, and this is where our evolution has really taken place, in the ancient world, people thought in terms of aphorisms, single ideas. If you read an ancient book on astrology, you'll see one line after the next of an idea, an idea, an idea, an idea. If Mercury is in Pisces and it's squaring the moon, then blah, blah, blah. If Jupiter is in its domicile and hit by the transiting sun, then blah, blah, blah. All disconnected. What brings us, what brings the enlightened world forward is this idea of conceptualization. Conceptualization only became possible with things like Gutenberg's press. When we begin to offshore our memories, we don't have to memorize everything. If you were considered smart in the ancient world, it was because you had the ability to memorize. You know, oh, a great scholar, you can recite Ovid, chapter 6. What line was that? You see? But as we come in now, we don't need to know that information. It's the wisdom that's more important, the implication of the knowledge. So starting with Gutenberg's press, we start offshoring information. We start taking our memories away, putting it into books. Witte comes along just at the cusp when we start recording things on a mass level, radio, large-scale printing, newspapers everywhere, the ability to record things on wax, on film. Television starts coming along, the ability to record these images as well. So we get to the internet, where now, and again, so Witte was right at that cusp of going from the first elements of offshoring memory, right, printing press, to the electronic media revolution that we are involved in now, and he invents an astrology that goes along with those evolutionary changes. And he doesn't really invent an astrology, he distills it. Everything in the Uranian system is contained in ancient astrology. It's just cleaned up and put in a very regular form, or a form that's easy to work with on a conceptual level. So we lose all the magic of astrology in a lot of levels, the idea that things are mysterious, you know. But we get a really good tool that's representative of the modern time.
When one thinks of Gary Christian, or hears the name Gary Christian, the first thing we think about is symmetrical astrology. Tell us a little bit about symmetrical astrology, what it is, and your concept of it. And I know you had, like, your own little twist on it. I know you had a group at one time that you, you know, if you still have the group, that you put together. But tell us a little bit about symmetrical astrology and its importance in the system.
Well, Witte is 100 years old now. He started studying with Carl Brand Leprecht in 1911. He started publishing the materials for the system in 1918, right after the war. So the system's approaching and passing its 100-year mark. It's out there. And like anything else, things begin to get old. Now, what Witte didn't do, he did not have access to, was the Babylonian material and the Mayan material. So the codex material really was only in primitive form. The Berlin Codex, Madrid Codex, and Berlin Codexes left over from the Mayans were really primitive at his time in terms of translation. And the Mayan material, they only found the libraries at the turn of the previous century, like 1804 or something like that, when they started excavating the libraries. And they don't, cuneiform is so difficult that they don't really begin to get good translations until the 1940s. Arthur Blackwell comes along in the late 50s, and he's working for the Strand Bookstore in New York City. And he's an astrologer studying the Fagan Allen systems, the sidereal systems promoted by those guys. And he starts getting into this Babylonian material. And he begins to realize that, oh, these guys were into something much larger than what the Greeks were into. And as a matter of fact, Greek astrology might be a very degenerative form of what the Babylonians were all about. Arthur starts getting into the idea of the horizon as the primary function. Vitta was geometric in nature and worked with planes. So everything in the Vittian systems is either reduced to the ecliptic, or it's reduced to the equator, the equatorial system, or heliocentric planes, but it's a two-dimensional system. Arthur comes along and he says, wait, there's this horizon plane, and all the Babylonians were concerned with was the horizon. There was no ecliptic as far as they were concerned, only the place where the stars are talking to one another. In other words, the writing, the heavenly writing, as that woman Rauschenberg puts it. So Arthur comes out, and Arthur's background is pretty bizarre. His father was a cartographer, made maps, worked for the UN, redrew a lot of the Arab maps. And his grandfather was a horologist, studied clocks. So, of course, they produce an astrologer. And he puts together a thing called a polar azimuthal equidistant projection. And you've seen these things. They're those little cardboard dual wheels that allow you to look up at the sky and figure out where the fixed stars are. But it's truly a three-dimensional horoscope form. You can actually make it, and particularly if you can make it dynamic. It's contained in chart wheels. And this polar azimuthal allows us to observe perons. And other derivatives from this concept are the Perron clock, Jim Valier's kinetic mundoscope, all these dynamic tools that all come out of this working with what actually is rising on the horizon, the relationship between what's rising on the horizon to the meridian, and how the place becomes really critical to the horoscope. And again, it becomes a 20th century concept because, again, in the 20th century, we begin to move all over the globe. So Vitta accounts for about 40% of symmetrical astrology. Blackwell comes along, and he accounts for, oh, another 30% to 40% as well. Not really, not quite as much as Vitta, because Vitta was very comprehensive. Blackwell brings in the fixed stars. He brings in all kinds of materials, but it's when you combine the two that magical things begin to happen. The third component to symmetrical, right, and remember, symmetrical is something that's supposed to change over time. It's not supposed to be static. It's a jumping off point for integrating future astrology. The traditional material is historical. The psychological material is the social context without technique. But symmetrical brings us into the future. Now, the third leg has to do with Rob Hand and hanging around with Rob. There was that period of time when astrology was under attack in the New York Times, we used to call them the Keystone Psychops, or the Committee for the Investigation for the Paranormal. And they attacked astrology, and people pointed out, hey, there's that Gauquelin stuff that you didn't look at. And they said, oh, we'll just disprove this material. And they went in, and they replicated the Gauquelin work, and lo and behold, the Gauquelin work stood up 100% against their attacks. So they did what all corrupt scientists would do. They fudged the data and changed it so that it wouldn't work well. Unfortunately, their only statistician in the crew blew the whistle on them publicly, big time. Like, hey, these guys are changing data because they don't like astrology, right? And this is after they hit front page of the New York Times. So that was pretty embarrassing for the PsyCops guys. They had to go back and say that the astrological thesis has merit. They called a press conference for it at the Waldorf Astoria, and they barred the press from it and the public, and made their announcement behind closed doors among four people, and never said another public word about it ever since. Now, we got really mad about all of this. This was a terrible thing, right? That, oh, my God, all this work to you know, bring the Gauquelin material forward, all this malfeasance by this group, the self-appointed group, and all they did was shove us under the rug. Well, we were at a conference in Mills College in about 1983-84, and Rob was going to do the plenary talk, and Bruce Schofield, myself, Doug Kellogg, a few other astrologers, we were all hanging around. We were all yelling about this thing, and we got Rob really mad, and he went up to the podium and threw his speech away and just started railing about astrology as a revolutionary science. That the astrological thesis itself is so threatening to the Enlightenment or orthodox sciences that they'll do anything in their power to suppress it. And it's this thesis, this idea of astrology as the antidote to the deadening effects of science. Remember, science has no soul. You know, science can make things like atomic bombs and chemicals that destroy life altogether. And they have no controls. I mean, there's no moral convictions going on there. You know, it's where they mix up religion and science and all this other jazz. The truth being, science is a religion. It's a belief system that's got boundaries, definitions. It's as magical as any other belief system. And astrology is one of those things that basically shows the cracks in the machine. If the astrological thesis is correct, that means science was founded on a lie. You know, they had to use the astrological scapegoat. I don't know how far you want me to get into it, but, I mean, I could give you one of the main reasons astrology fell and why this revolution is extremely important. I mean, if we go back to Gutenberg's press, critical time, the first thing after Gutenberg does the Bible, right? I mean, that was a natural seller. They had to make money on this project. It took them 10 years to get this whole thing together. It was mostly making metal fonts. And once he does the Bible, the next thing that is produced are astrological almanacs. And they sell like hotcakes. And we get to the point by 1665, right? They're the hottest selling things on the planet. People are regarding astrologers much more so than the clergy in terms of moral authority. Well, Dee comes along and puts out an almanac with a picture of London burning for the 1666 edition. And, of course, London burns to the ground in 1666. Astrology becomes so credible that the new enlightened thinkers don't know what to do with it because they're in jeopardy themselves because the Anglican Church is going crazy over all of this stuff. Not only was the Church past its post-Reformation period, but it was trying to reestablish itself as the supreme moral authority, and it was getting eroded by guys like Locke and all these other characters, these mechanistic, enlightened characters. So they made a deal. To make the world safe for Anglicanism, they would discredit the astrologers who were now usurping the priests' moral powers because they're so popular. So we begin to see the moral decay of astrology all the way down the line. And we see that the scientists, these newly found scientists, discredit astrology in antithesis to their own beliefs, which is the search for truth. In other words, astrology was just put up and shot against the firing squad because it would let them survive against the church. So this astrology is a revolutionary thesis. astrology is the one thing that could underpin the mechanist view of the world at this point in time is critical. And that's the third leg of symmetrical astrology, the philosophical underpinning of things that we lack in our orthodox astrology. You know, the orthodox view of astrology is, well, we've got this tool, let's use it, and, you know, the ancient wisdom is great. But there's no reason, there's no rationale as to, you know, why we are just a bunch of weirdo deviants sitting around in a room playing with material that was long ago discredited. I mean, why are we doing these things? And we're involved in a truth. And we're involved in a truth that gets the laugh track turned on at every turn. So it's critical that we get to the point where astrology itself becomes accepted just as it is. But astrology as it is not an acceptable subject. It's a historical oddity.
Hey, Gary, we got somebody calling in.
Sure.
I'm going to bring this caller on. 347-583, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Gary.
Yes.
Hello, my name is Dave. I'm calling from actually from New York. And I have some questions relevant to the method and technique of symmetrical astrology specifically. The
okay.
first thing I'd like to ask you is, how integral are the transneptunians in symmetrical astrology?
Well, the transnepts usually get top billing when people are trying to sell Uranian astrology or trying to distract from it because they're so bizarre. Now, here are planets or factors that are discovered by Vitta using Vitta's techniques to demonstrate how powerful astrology is. In essence, he was attempting to discover planets using astrology and then have the astronomers point telescopes at those factors and find the planets as a proof of astrology. Well, that was all well and good, and of course it gave the system a really bad name for a very long time. It allowed things like cosmobiology to break away from it just on the strength that, oh, how can we believe in these funny planets, you know? Well, we get to the modern era, and the Kuiper Belt is proposed in 1951. And by 1990, they're beginning to find objects in the Kuiper Belt. Now, by definition, Pluto is a Kuiper Belt object. So by definition, the Kuiper Belt is 240 year orbits to 700-year orbits. In other words, that band is considered
right.
The main band of the Kuiper Belt. Vitta proposed four planets, and Seeger and the other four,
right.
That had orbital elements of 262 years to 720 years. He defines the Kuiper Belt 80 years before its discovery. That's pretty good. This is something that people haven't put together. Now, the strength of these factors, how much do we integrate them into our day-to-day use in symmetrical work?
Exactly.
Is basically when I teach the system, when I show people how the system works, the technique, I do not teach the transneps. I bring
okay.
the trans. So if we were teaching, say, a 10-week course, I would bring the transneps in around week eight or nine and say, hey, look, these things are very powerful, and they're going to work, they're going to show, but you've already seen a demonstration of the system standing alone without them, because it was those techniques that found them in the first place.
Okay.
They're the proof of the work.
Correct. In terms of the working orbs in symmetrical astrology,
yes.
In the natal context, what harmonic do you consider a valid connection? On the 90-degree dial, are you stopping at the quadrature, which is 22.5 or the 16th harmonic? Are you going to 11.25, 5.625? Where do you find the validation of the natal connections ending?
11.25 when it's really tight. 5.38s come in, but, you know, you're really getting far away from the main sequence. So they could only add very little information to a combination. Now, even the 11.25 should be looked at with a grain of salt, only when it's very precise, say within 5 minutes or so. We get down to 22 and a half, and we're going to keep it around 15 minutes either side at best. Okay. But when we get down to the half square, the interesting thing between the squares, the conjunction, and the opposition, and then the 45s, the 135 and the 45, seems to have to do, there's a very big difference here where the 45 and 135 seem to be externalized in terms of their operation. The squares and the oppositions and conjunctions, the larger material, which again, we keep our orbs down to like possibly 3, maybe 4 degrees on that, except unless the lights are involved. When we're dealing with those guys, we're dealing with conditions that are internalized. So, for example, if Saturn transits your sun, you're going to feel the Saturn internally. It's going to be part of your being, and the events that manifest are going to be organically connected to you. You know, it's like, yeah, I knew that would happen. You know, but whereas Saturn makes the half square to the sun or sesquiquadrate, here the event is externalized. We're not under Saturn. We don't feel like we're under Saturn. We're not. We don't have that pall over our life. But yet we walk down the street and the policeman says, hey, you know, you're blocking the sidewalk. I got to give you a ticket now. And you're going to have to go to court. It's going to be a pain in the ass. That's how a half square would operate. It's something like that's very externalized to the person. And again, keep those orbs down under 2 degrees on the square and the half square.
And you've actually found that in practice, reference to the eighth harmonic?
Yes. Yes. So even in the way the eighth harmonic is constructed, if you think of the eight-armed cross, right, you have this big square, and then you have these four points around it, right, the little squares. And the big squares, the conjunction, the opposition, the square itself, each one of those factors has a Cadan and Cardinal house around it, or Cadan and Cardinal sign concept around it. So, for example, the meridian, squaring the ascendant, right? You have a ninth house and a tenth house, and you have a 12th house and a first house. It's always a Cadan and Cardinal. Whereas
right.
In that scheme, the fixed houses stand alone. They're the 45 points. They're the material manifestation of things in the world. So the 45s, and so the half squares and the sesquiquadrates start becoming the stuff that stands outside of the self.
So you're equating them with 2, 5, 8, and 11.
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Now, in relation to prediction, and again, mm-hmm. getting back to harmonic relevance,
mm-hmm.
in terms of solar arc theory,
mm-hmm.
when an arcing planet arrives, where do you see the orb of impact ending? In what harmonic do you take that to?
It really doesn't matter because here we can go into absolutes. We're dealing with solar arcs, 5 minutes is your max.
No, I'm talking about 11 and a quarter versus 5.625.
Even when we're getting into a small arc like that, if we're like this is the one area where an 11 and a quarter actually does shine in a fan. When we look at a 90-degree dial, we see like a fan of planets here. If you've got an 11 and a quarter operating within 5 minutes of arc and it's coming due by direction, it's going to produce an event. Now it's not going to have the wide ranging effect of say a large long forming square. You know, the duration of the event's going to be shorter, the impact's going to be less, but it's still going to happen nonetheless. So again, it's a small, very very tiny arc on that. You know, 4 to 5 minutes of arc on anything will work. Will produce something dynamic.
Robert Leshek had introduced the concept of holographic transits,
mm-hmm.
which were a duplication of the arc opening in the sky relevant to the Earth chart opening of certain factors. Now, I know that you say equal arcs equal planetary pitches.
Correct.
When two planets in the sky have an arc equal to two planets in your chart,
mm-hmm.
the planetary pitch or the symmetry is actually between A natal and B transit, and C natal forms a symmetry with D transit.
Correct.
And that's what produces the central axis.
Yes.
How is it explained that the midpoints, consisting of one part natal and one part transit, actually come together to produce a dynamic on a common axis?
Well, here you get a situation where you start seeing unique events or unique placement. For example, if I, the old bar trick, you know, I used to walk around with the Fowler's Ephemeris in my back pocket, and I'd hang around at the bar when I was a young man, and I could just take somebody's age, right? Oh, you're 21 years old, you're born in the summertime, your solar arc's going to be about 20 and a half.
Right.
And I could look in the, and I could, and then just all I had to do was know their birthday. Oh, you're born on July 18th. Okay, so about 26 degrees, 27 degrees of Cancer, right? And I could look in the ephemeris, and I could look to see where are their 20 and a half degree openings.
Right.
Now, all I need to do is find one, and I know that it will connect the natal sun, the directed sun, and the two transits in the sky, and it will personalize the event. Now, if I saw somebody, say, with Saturn and was a pretty girl and had Saturn and Venus coming due, well, I would talk about their future, and they'd have to buy me a drink. But if it was a pretty girl and Venus and Mars were coming due, I'd buy them a drink.
Gary, I got to ask you, when are you going to write a book?
This is one of my larger things that I really have to do over the course of this summer. I gave some classes over at Kepler, and it allowed me to organize a lot of work, and it also made me realize I have a whole bunch of material written, and it's just a matter of stringing it together. So that is my summertime goal, is to at least get a preliminary textbook out, and then other people can write a million things afterwards and take it from there. But just the one thing that says, look, here's A, here's B, here's C, here's D, and this is the succession it all should go. You know, here's the elements that I think should be in it, you know?
Listen, I know we're coming to the end of the show. I just wanted you to know we're all waiting for that book.
Oh, thank you. That's great. That's both good and bad, you know?
It was nice talking to you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Hey, Gary, I wanted to ask you about, you know, people always say that during the time that Vida was, you know, in World War I, World War II, that there was this whole connection of Hitler with Uranian astrology, and I just wanted your intake on it, because you were the one that really was connected to these guys and really had the real in-depth story of what was the connection with Hitler and Uranian astrology during that time.
Hitler hated astrology with a passion. You know, it starts in 1921, 22, when he does that beer hall putz, when he starts the revolution. And Elsbeth Eberton, who studied astrology with Alfred Witte, under Karl Brandl of Pracht in 1911, they were both in the same class. Right, this woman, Elsbeth Eberton, she was the mother of Reinhold Eberton, who goes on and does cosmobiology. She was writing a column, and it was a very famous column at the time. She was a very, very well-regarded writer. And somebody wrote in and gave Hitler's birth data and said, this man is going to be the great leader of Germany. What do you think? And she said, yes, he's going to be the greater captain of Germany. He's a wonderful guy. He's great. It's wonderful, right? Except he shouldn't do anything in November of 1922. I think it was 22, yeah. You shouldn't do anything in November. You should refrain from all stuff, right? And, of course, this was brought to Hitler's attention, and Hitler's dismissed it completely and says, oh, what do the stars have to do with me? I'm greater than the stars. And he went out and did the putz and broke his arm and was thrown in jail. He did not like that. I like astrology. But the higher-ups in the Nazi regime never forgot Elsbeth Eberton. And they always were very sympathetic to astrology. But there was another problem that comes up. During the 30s, the Germans began burning books that were written by foreign sources. They wanted to clean up the Aryan image, so to speak. So they started banning books, burning books, censoring things. By 1937, the first book banned by the Nazis that was written by an Aryan was The Rules for Planetary Pictures. They seized all of Rudolph's stocks, burned them. He managed to save one copy. He thought that was a great victory. By 1939 and 1940, the war had started, and Rudolf Hess flies to Scotland. It was a big embarrassment for the Germans. He was a high-up Nazi commander, and he was going to try to end the war independently, but he was really a nutcase. The Germans start the Gestapo starts a process called Aktion Hess. And with Aktion Hess, they rounded all the astrologers up, the metaphysicians, the gypsies, this and that, and they threw a bunch of them in jail. But if you were a white Aryan guy, they just slapped you on the wrist and took your books away and sent you home. Witte commits suicide in the Nazi Gestapo van at this point in time when they arrest him in 1940. Okay, time goes on. The Germans are doing propaganda using Nostradamus. The British are doing propaganda using Nostradamus. They're both dropping leaflets on each other. They're on the U-boats particularly. They're saying, oh, you're all going to die. The Germans arrest a guy named Karl Ernst Kraft, a Swiss astrologer who practices in Berlin in spite of the Nazi ban on astrology. They put him in the concentration camps. They make him produce all the works on this propaganda movement. One of the guys that worked with him was another guy in the internment camps called Wilhelm Wolff. Wilhelm Wolff wrote a book after the war called Zodiac and Swastika. Very good book, right? And he was a Iranian astrologer. He had studied with Witte, and he combined it with Hindu techniques. So he was this very strange, eclectic little system. Kraft dies of dysentery in 1945, before the end of the war. The Nazis are all in the shelters. The war is coming to an end. There is no hope. Himmler calls for Wolff to give an assessment of where the Nazis are going to be. Wolff produces a report that basically says that Germany would be suffering a very dark time until 1947, where it will turn around and become the economic powerhouse of Europe. The Nazis start dancing on the tables. They think that it's in their favor. They start pointing to this document. They bring it to Hitler's attention, and he throws them out of the room. Within 2 weeks, Hitler is dead. Wolff is freed. He writes his book, and the matter is forgotten. Now, there was a guy named de Waal in England who used the idea of Kraft working for Hitler to get himself a job and write reports for the British intelligence. But, hey, that's the way that goes. So the Iranian system really had nothing to do with it, except for the fact that they were the first books banned by the Nazis. The Nazis hated astrology. Witte hated astrology. I mean, the Hitler hated astrology. But the certain guys in the higher command, Himmler, Goebbels, and a few others, were sympathetic to it because of Elsbeth Eberton. I hope that answers that question.
Yeah. One of the questions I wanted to ask you is tell us a little bit about Astrolabe and Solar Fire and Overchart Wheels. How did you get involved with Astrolabe? You've been with the company for a long, long time. How did you get involved with it? And tell us a little bit about the software and some of the things that you guys have going on with Noah Chocolates and all your new software.
Well, you got to go back to the 70s, and Rob, myself, Bruce Schofield, various others, we're all hanging around the New York area. And Rob was up in Boston. And we began getting calculators as they came out. When the first Balmor Brain came out in 1970, Rob ran out and bought the Radio Shack knockoff. It could add, subtract, and divide, you know, and multiply. It even had a memory. And we were figuring out how to do ascendant and mid-heavens right then and there. Now, this progressed to the point where Rob wrote Planets in Transit in 1974 or 75, and the royalties began rolling in. And I was working for the steel company by 1976, and I had my own little calculator computer at that time, had a little tape drive memory. And again, we were putting together planetary routines. All through that time, I was going crazy looking for a clock chip that could do sidereal time, so I could make a sidereal clock, an LED sidereal clock. But and so Rob and I got together about 1977 and 78 and said, hey, you know, we're doing all this computer stuff. We got all these routines going. Matrix Magazine had started by Michael Erlewine as a nonprofit thing. And we started talking about the idea of putting together Astrographics Services, Inc., which would be the precursor to Astrolabe. And we wanted to use the software to make tools and tables that nobody else was making, like sidereal ephemerides, graphic tables, because the Ebertons were going out of business at that point. They weren't doing. It was hard to get those German graphs. And Rob got a plotter, and I was doing. I was hanging around stat shops in New York, photography shops that could make reproductions and things. So we were, I was going back and forth to Cape Cod, and we started putting the business together. And we decided to put it together as a brain trust. We had to decide whether it was going to be nonprofit or profit. And a guy came along and had a piece of jewelry that was an astrological piece of jewelry called the Stardate Pendant. And he sold it to American Express and wanted us to do all the horoscopes. We had to write the routines for that. And that actually got the company going. Our first program was called A1. It was an Apple program that we had written out of the CPM code at the time. That was the operating system at the time, was CPM. And we started the business. And it was within a couple of months of Matrix. He actually started selling routines on cassette a few months before we started selling routines, because everybody wanted the software. They didn't want the books and the tables and tools we wanted to make with the stuff. And it took off from there. Now, by the mid-'80s, Nova was launched. And Nova led to a program called the AstroAnalyst. And the AstroAnalyst, the screen viewing module, became Chart Wheels. And it was the first, and that was in 1989, and it was the first interactive, graphically-based astrology program. And we were approached in 1993 by Graham Dawson of Esoteric Technologies, and he had written a Windows program, and it was a year ahead of where we were with Windows. So we took that on. He wanted us to publish it. And we published it and gave technical advice and this and that, and Solar Fire was born. And during the 90s, we perfected Solar Fire and began to work with the early version of Chart Wheels, which was always the pet program, right? Solar Fire took off by 1998 and became one of the dominant programs out there. We've always considered it to be an encyclopedic program, one that has a little bit of everything in it. Chart Wheels, however, was always our in-house program. And we come to around 2001, and the trade towers fall, and I'm going off to New York that year and to do my solstice speaking. I would do the solstice chart and stuff. And I went to the programmer here, Ray White. I said, Ray, I can't use this piece of junk anymore. It's falling apart. I don't have any machines that'll run it any longer, you know, the old chart wheels. And we had made a screen viewing module for a dial in Windows. So we took it and we just screwed around with it, made a little bit of this and that. And we made it a little bit more. And by 2003, something real strange happened. We invented this thing called the working data box. Now, in Chart Wheels is this, that moving data box concept where the whole chart was geared to whatever the current date was or whatever date we put into. So solar arcs would be calculated, or everything dynamic would start to happen with that. And we realized that we had created something that wasn't in our spec. It was actually beyond what we wanted to do, but really had great potential. So then we began to work on planetary picture materials, adding more and more to the paradigm, and it just ran away with itself. Because we weren't looking to sell it to an audience. I mean, it was just like this thing with my tools, you know. But Chart Wheels it's still beta. We still consider it beta. But Chart Wheels has taken off and become its own little world unto itself. So we consider Chart Wheels to be a very professional program. It's put together for the way a pro would approach the work. the things that you need for a client, as opposed to a solar fire type of program, which is an encyclopedia. You know, encyclopedia has a little bit of everything in it. But Chart Wheels has certain core routines that are really, really strong. Now, of course, my prejudice is with the Iranian system and Vita's ideas. So it's all there. But as far as any sidereal, any work dealing with Perons and stuff, it's all in the program. We helped write a lot of Chart Wheels. And we, in particular, he got to Chart Wheels 3 before he left the company. And we put in all the ancient materials he had developed. There was really only one or two things that aren't in there he wanted to do, and they had to do with primaries. Now, that primary material has now found its way into Solar Fire. This year, the Solar Fire primary work is just excellent. And we were carrying a program by a guy named Ruman Koloff, who called Placidus 3D, which was the knockout drop-dead primary program. He's gone on to write a very, very good Babylonian program, but these are very esoteric programs. I mean, they're very difficult to run. You really have to know your stuff to utilize them, but the guy's way ahead of his time, and he's out in Bulgaria. So we like his stuff. So the primaries became an issue, but I think where we're going to go with the primaries, where I've been going with it for a long time, have to do with this thing called the kinetic mundoscope, which we're going to put into Chart Wheels. It was done by Jim Valliere. He won a Mark Edmund Jones Award for it. And it basically, a kinetic mundoscope tells us what this, what's obliquely rising and culminating at any given time of the day at a given location. And it's a square kind of a layout. But the virtue of it is that if you do a kinetic mundoscope and start it from your birthday, you get a mundane secondary progression that works like a mundane primary better than a primary layout. It's real strange. But I'm getting way off topic. But the idea is that, you know, Astrolabe became this brain trust where people have come and gone over the years, and we really strive to do the right thing. In other words, we don't just call somebody up and say, hey, how do you do that technique and try and implement it? We have to learn it. Everything in those programs, we have learned, tested, and checked out. And everybody has challenged us from here to eternity about the whole thing. Now, the last project that we're involved in regarding all of this is the ACS Atlas. Maria Sims, Neil Mickelson's wife, his last wife before he died, repurchased all of the assets of Astro Computing Services and called us up and said, we want you guys to oversee the Atlas for us. And we've been working on that ever since. It got us in real trouble. We didn't realize that people had been ripping off the Atlas for years and years and years and years. And thank you, Ray. Okay, Ray. That's the programmer came and dropped some things off. This Atlas thing, though, now we've been working on it for 5 years, and we're over the course of the next 6 months or so, we'll be able to re-release it as a really complete piece of work. It has languished for quite some time. So that's another piece of thing. We're not going to make any money on the Atlas, but Maria really wanted us to work on it, and we're pretty proud of it because it's one of the integral things needed for astrology. So that's been going on. And down the road, we're going to have to get into more portable apps and that sort of stuff. There's a knockoff out there called Astro Gold, but it's not Solar Fire. You know? Anything else I can tell you about?
Within your research of everything that's going on now, have you found any new findings, any new concepts with the Uranian system that
azimuthal with three-dimensional planetary pictures. In other words, we began working with great circle pictures. In other words, instead of where Victor reduces things to a plane, right, and we take a midpoint, say, between two factors on a given plane, well, you know, Pluto may be fairly north of the ecliptic, and the moon might be a little south and this and that. When you begin to do planetary pictures, and if you do them in great circle measurement, in other words, throw the ecliptic out the window and just measure between the factors involved as a great circle, you get way off the ecliptic. Some of these factors could be anywhere on the Earth, and they start becoming extremely sensitive locally. So I've been working with these concepts now for a while. I did a demonstration of some of it when I did and analyzed the Buddy Holly crash for the Kepler classes, and it worked out very well. It seems to be following theory extremely well. So that seems to be the new area, is using the local horizon, the local sphere, doing symmetrical work within that local sphere. The next step is to really begin to integrate the fixed stars into the schema. So that's one of the areas I'll be moving towards. Okay.
Could you tell our listeners how can they get a copy of Solify and Nova Top Wheels? How could they sign up for any of your software products?
Well, if they go to Astrolabe's site, www.alabe.com, Alabe is one way to pronounce it. It's actually Astrolabe without the stro. It's the only way we get that name. But if you go to our website, you can sign up for what's called our auguries. Now, auguries have evolved over time. It used to be a newsletter with a lot of articles in it, but now it's more of a communication medium, you know, with ads in it. People seem to respond more to ads than data these days. But if they get on the auguries list, anything we're doing, we'll let you know about. Okay, Madeline Hillis-Deneen runs auguries for us, and she sends out stuff, I'd say about once every 3 or 4 weeks something will come out. But let's everybody know what we're doing, what's coming up next, what events are going on at Astrolabe. For example, we actually have events here on Cape Cod, where we exist in the town of Brewster. Tad Mann is going to be coming down and speaking to us on his work on I believe it's May 30th. Madeline just sent it out. Let me see if I've got I should have it here. I'm way too far. Oh, I was looking at something. I can't find it. All right, here we go. Let's see. News. Here we go. Yeah, the event is going to be on May 30th and 31st at Astrolabe in Brewster. You can call us up at 508-896-5081 Eastern Time, 10 to 5, and get information on that. He's going to do a workshop on astrology before birth, and he's going to do a lecture on astrology and your reincarnations. So that's a local event. We do some of that stuff. I do the yearly solstice here as well, generally anywhere from October through the beginning of December when the date is appropriate. And I do solstice prediction for the year. Madeline occasionally does some events here as well. So the auguries list will keep you apprised of everything that's happening in general. Now, there's also symmetricalastrology.com as a website that is slowly getting built. It's, you know, we only have so much time for things, but we're slowly getting that together for the symmetrical community. And we're thinking of a symmetrical conference, we call SE2, for either March, April, or May of 2015. We expect it will be in the Northeast. We're trying to do a very different construct for a conference. We want to make it a live event, right? People come for the conference itself, and a webinar experience at the same time. And we're thinking of charging more for the webinar than the actual live experience, so bodies will be here. You get to pay for the privilege of hanging around at your house in your underwear, you know, watching the thing on television. But we expect we're going to do two tracks, one track for people who want to learn symmetrical, and one track of presenters, which will be, they'll be given fixed topics to speak on. This will be the third third symmetrical conference. The first one was number zero, the second one was number one in Atlanta. So we're working on that as well, but we don't have firm dates or firm anything. Okay.
So, Gary, let me ask you a quick question. When you're doing the Capricorn Ingress prediction at the end of the year, are you doing it personally for students who are in the class, or are you just doing it overall just for the whole country, or what exactly are you looking at when you do it?
When I'm doing straight solstice work, like the lecture and all that other jazz, it's usually in a couple of component parts. The first part is a general talk about where we are in the world in terms of the really large combinations out in the sky. So, for example, this last solstice, we talked a lot about the Grand Cross and this and that. And then we actually look at the solstice chart itself for different locations on the planet, trends, events. Sometimes fashion material seems to predominate, sometimes murders and deaths, sometimes wars. Right now we're at the kickoff of the resource wars. They're starting to come into focus now. And then the third part used to be the old optional part. I don't do it very often anymore, but I used to do individual readings off the solstice chart as entertainment for the people who come. You know, use it as a technique where you could do, you could process a lot of people predictive-wise for the course of the year, like an augury, like an oracle, you know, but process them very quickly. In other words, like 5 or 10 minutes per person, and yet it's very unique. So that would be the third part. But I went
so
crazy.
So the third part.
Pardon?
You would just add in the person's natal sun on the solstice and just read the axis?
Yes, to do that technique. The technique is simple and it's very effective. You basically place the natal sun into the solstice horoscope, generally on a 90-degree dial as opposed to a 360, and then direct the sun by solar arc and take that position. And you use the solar arc sun for the date of the solstice. So that you'd calculate your solar arc for the, say it's December 21st, 2014, you'd calculate the solar arc directed sun position for that date, and then proceed to move the solar arc sun forward by 1 degree for the course of the year. You know, obviously very precisely, of course, if the person is a winter birth, it's going to be 61 minutes, summer birth 57, but you move it accordingly, and whatever pictures it hits off while it's moving, you time it in reference to the year, in proportion to the year. So if it's something, if an event occurs, if a picture occurs with this directed sun, 30 minutes, that's 6 months after the solstice. If it's 15 minutes, that's 3 months after the solstice, etc. Now, generally, we'll go 6 weeks before the solstice, because you can go before the time, to around 9 to 10 months after the solstice. Now, other ingresses, this time frame is a little bit less. So if we're working with, say, the Aries ingress or the summer solstice chart, your timing on that is basically only about 4 months going forward, 4 to 5 months. But the winter solstice is the granddaddy, and you can definitely pull out a good 9 months ahead. So you'll get about 8 or 9 events or 8 or 9 pictures that will come due. Generally by midpoint, because it's really hard to figure out all the various planetary pictures that could possibly come due, but you'll see a few of those too. And you just delineate them. And the interesting thing about these things is they stand alone. It's definitely like an oracle, because you know, you get this thing comes out of the blue, you know, oh, Vulcanus comes due with Jupiter, you know, you're going to make a lot of money in this period of time. Now, the time frame is to the minute of arc, and give a two-minute orb on either side. So that would mean a 1 week on either side of the predicted time of the event would be appropriate. So suppose that we have the sun directed in going into the moon-Jupiter midpoint on the solstice chart, and it's happening 20 minutes. The sun has to move 20 minutes from a solar arc position to get there. That's approximately 4 months, right, 5 minutes per month. And we would say, well, you know, 4 months after the solstice, right, which would be around April 21st, right? You're going to have a very good time with money. You're going to be very expansive. Take advantage of all opportunities. This will be in effect any time for a week before to a week after that date. That's its orb, and that would be it. And you go on to the next one, and then do it in reverse. Use the converse solar arc position as well, and run the year backwards, so to speak. In other words, lose a degree, and get the other side as well. They'll be just as effective, the events that come out of that. It's a very easy system for processing, like, say, a room full of people, and you want to give them a little something that's going to be valid.
A quick question. If you the 360-degree dial, is it used in symmetrical astrology? And if so, what houses?
We use the 360. We only use quadrant houses like Porphyry or Koch or something like that, only to look at the chart from a day level. So with the pizza pie chart becomes important just to see, well, what's the most elevated planet? What's below the horizon? What's east? What's west? You know, that sort of thing. Then we go right into the 360. At that point, we drop the quadrant house system altogether. We don't need it. We'll be using what are called auxiliary houses. You can create a house structure, an equal house structure, around any factor in the horoscope. Each factor carries that framework with it. The only one that isn't on the ecliptic with this framework is the meridian. The midheaven is a function of the equator, so it makes equal houses on the equator. But you think of this 12-fold equal house system really is an aspectarian dial, and they're just very sensitive points. So, for example, if I'm going to look at houses on a 360 and I say I want to look at the sun houses, I would make the sun the fourth house cusp, and then 30 degrees ahead of the sun would be the fourth house, the next 30 degrees the fifth house, etc. And this would tell me about the father and about the male characteristics and the aim in life. Whereas if I went to the moon and made a moon horoscope, right, I would place the pointer on the moon, and here I would make the moon the 10th house cusp. Now, I'm being arbitrary here because Vitta was arbitrary. He had his reasons. We won't get into it now, but this is where we would place it. Just like the meridian is the cusp of the 10th, so is the moon. And again, wherever the moon is, the next 30 degrees after the moon would be the cusp of the 10th house, the next 30 degrees after that, the 11th house, etc. So we would have a lunar horoscope, which would tell us about the hereditary on the mother's side, the feminine qualities, the woman itself, if it's a woman's chart, the man's feminine abilities, the sensitivity, the dealing with the public, etc. So, for example, we could say, Venus, right, would be, say, as an example, might be 45 degrees ahead of the sun, would be in the sun's fifth house. So the man would be speculative in his love relations and be happy-go-lucky, whereas that same Venus might lie ahead of the moon by, say, 70 degrees or so and be in the moon's 12th house. So from an emotional point of view, the love experience isn't always a pleasant one, or they're hidden from the person's emotional point of view, or publicly the person isn't going to be demonstrating their Vesuvian qualities. Or, as another example here, say the Jupiter is squaring the moon ahead of the moon, right, in front of the moon. That would be the first house of the lunar horoscope. And we would say, well, the mother's heredity on the mother's side of the family is very good. They had they were well-to-do, or they were happy-go-lucky, and that sort of thing. Whereas we may have Saturn squaring the sun from behind and be on the first house of the sun horoscope, and we could say, well, the father's heredity is much more difficult. You know, there's a lot of problems there. There's a lot of baggage coming in from the father's side of the chart, etc. So the house systems move around depending upon the point of view, which is one of the features of the system itself, is the fact that everything goes from whatever point of view you're looking at. So if we're looking at the point of view of the sun, we're talking about the masculine qualities. We look at the point of view of the moon, the feminine or responsive qualities. And then the various house systems that go around these things start interplaying as well. Now, the Germans themselves, they will direct those auxiliary cusps and look for planetary pictures connecting the cusps. So you might have a midpoint, say, between the moon and the eighth house cusp of the sun, equaling a picture, say, with Jupiter and the fourth house cusp of the sun horoscope, something like that. Where you'll have the house cusps interplanetary interacting with these various planets and creating these planetary pictures, which, again, there's so much information unlocked in the system, you have to decide what it is you're going to look at using your own technique. So personally, I don't work too much with the auxiliary house systems because I get so much information just working with the planets themselves.
Do you in predictive work, do you look at the solar return or the lunar return on the 90-degree dial?
I will look at. I used to do return charts all the time. I mean, I was a dyed-in-the-wool sidereolist for a while there. But these days, no, I don't do the returns very often. Again, you would treat them just like you would treat an ingress, and the timing of them would be the same. You could move the meridian in a solar return either 361 degrees a year or just 1 degree, depending upon how you're going to do it. But again, these charts are wide in scope. They're like symbolic charts of what the year is supposed to be like, or the influences that are coming up in that, you know, prior to the birthday and shortly afterwards. But again, I get so much information out of the straight dynamics. I don't need to look at an auxiliary chart unless it's striking. You know, if somebody were born, like, say, on March 9th or something like that, when the Grand Cross was really at its peak, you know, April 21st, when the Grand Cross was really at its peak, right, I'd say, hey, you have quite a solar return this year, you know. It's going to be jumping. But other than that, I'll be so concentrated. There's so much information. I'll spend so much time just working with the regular planets that, you know, we can't do everything.
And so you use the, for prediction work, you just use the ingress exclusively, or what other techniques do you use for prediction?
Actually, the ingresses I use for public work, not for individual client work. It's for stuff that, to demonstrate things to the public very easily because it's such a fast, simple method. But no, when I'm working with the client, when I do a reading, I break it into a few parts. The first part is looking at the chart itself, obviously, the natal. But that's for me. That's not for the client. The client can get entertained by it. But they should, by the time, you know, they're not 15-year-olds when they come for a reading. You know, they're not searching for themselves. Usually clients come, they're in their 20s to 70s, and they have had experience of themselves. So when you tell them things out of their natal chart, it's entertainment for them. But for you as the practitioner, you're interrogating the client to find out whether that Sun Jupiter has manifested as just a happy-go-lucky individual who goes from one, you know, lucky spell to the next, or whether they used it properly and got along well with authority and expanded their lives. I mean, we have to figure out what level these things are operating at. So the first 40 minutes of a reading or so, I'm just going over the natal chart for me. That's for me, you know, so I can figure out how this chart's going to work. Then the next hour or so is very mind-numbing for the client. I tell them not to take notes, just sit there and chill, because I'm going to record this. You go back and listen to it later. And when you listen to it later, you could stop the tape, start the tape, you know, stop the recording, start the recording, and write it all on a calendar, because I'll be all over the place. And when I start to approach the chart, I try and look at the larger view of the chart. What's the big stuff going on? You know, what are the lights getting hit with? Are there major combinations going on? Are there major directions going on? I try and get as large a material as possible and then begin to work to the smaller material. And then as I work into the smaller material, I begin to work what I call threads. So I'll just track Saturn for a course of time. Then I'll go back and I'll track Jupiter for a course of time. Then I'll go back and I'll track Mars, perhaps, for shorter periods of time, little things, just for timing purposes. You know, when is that Mars going to kick off that big axis, you know? Is Mercury coming in on that big axis? That sort of thing. And I'm all over the place. And at first blush, it looks very chaotic. But when the client goes back and puts it all on a piece of paper, a pattern forms that's unique to them and has, you know, has everything covered. We all have days where in the morning we walk out of the house and we find a $5 bill sitting on the ground. And then later that day, the policeman finds us for running a red light. You know, the days are not just good and bad. There's good and bad in every single day. The same thing when we do electional work or anything else like that. We're electing a time. Most of the time, people are winning, even in retrogrades. People are winning, even during voids. People are losing during these times as well. We could take any given time and create an electional that would be successful, because these things are happening all the time. But we have to find that right slot during the course of the day when it's the sweet spot of the day. So it's the same thing with this business of reading the horoscope, where, you know, we're going to drop out a lot of information, and the client himself will organize it. And if the client goes to that work, puts in their homework, they'll get a very good guidebook for the course of the reading. Now, the length of a reading really shouldn't be dictated by time. A lot of astrologers have to say, okay, today's, May 15th, you come back next May 15th for your next reading. I go basically by chapter, by major combination to major combination. And if it's 2 years between major combinations, that's the length of the reading. If it's only 9 months till the next major combination, that's the length of the reading. You know, so it's basically from crisis to crisis, because that's mostly what people are coming to you for in the first place. They've usually exhausted everything else. Hell, let's go see what the astrologer has to say, you know, and then usually we're right. We're usually cleaning up the worst mess of all. You know, they've already been to therapists and everything else and wondering why they're so depressed or can't sleep at night or whatever it is that's going on. And then we usually can get something done in one or two sessions with a client, and they usually walk away pretty happy, hopefully.
Well, we want to thank Gary Christian for being on the show today, taking the time out of his busy schedule, gave us a great amount of information. I want to thank all the callers for calling in, those of you that joined us in the chat room. We're definitely are very, very honored and grateful for you, Gary, being on the show today. Just real quick before we end the show, could you just give us your website and contact information for those that may want to buy software on Overchart Wheels or stay connected to your group, your symmetrical astrology group that you have going on?
It all starts and ends at Astrolabe. So any way you get to Astrolabe is the way to get in touch with me. So you can get in touch with us at www.alabe.com. Now, I come from North Jersey, so my B's sound like D's. I come from the land of D's, Dem, and Do's. But it's A is in Apple, L is in Larry, A is in Apple, B is in Boy, E is in Edward.com. We'll get you in the door, so to speak. Our phone number is 1-508-896-5081. And the 800 line, I don't know the digits, but it was always the Nova. So it's 1-800-THE-NOVA would be the 800 line. Those things are getting a little scarcer these days. And those two features should be able to get you involved with anything going on over here. If you want to write to me, you can write to me at uranian517@gmail.com. So uranian517, those are numerals, at Gmail, and I'll be able to pick that up as well. And I want to thank you for having me. It isn't often that they drag me out of the back room and put me in front of people. So,
definitely. We definitely appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. We definitely want to stay connected to you and everything that you got going on, especially me, those of us that are part of the Iranian community. We definitely want to stay connected to you and continue to learn and grow and expand in the knowledge and wisdom that we have before us. So we're definitely grateful once again for you being on the show. And just before we end the show, I'd like to say one thing. Your destiny is not a matter of chance, but it's a matter of choice. Thank you once again, Gary, for tuning in and being on the show. And we'll see you guys next week. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Bye-bye now.
Geico presents Sharing versus Oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance. Geico presents Sharing versus Oversharing. Earlier this week, Claire Tippins shared a princess nickname generator, 3 pictures of her dog wearing a tutu, and 2 online quizzes, including, what candy is your dream castle made of? Claire, your sharing has tipped the sugar scale and turned into oversharing. But have no fear, princess. Geico has something worth sharing with your internet kingdom, like how you could save hundreds on your car insurance just by visiting geico.com. No magic wand required. Geico, 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.